Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another week of the podcast. This week, I get to interview a dear friend, Janet Davidson. And I met this gorgeous woman right after I'd moved to Santa Fe. I was hustling and trying to find work and ended up bartending at a super swanky gallery opening. There I was in my little cute dress, serving beer and wine to all the illustrious guests that had chosen to stop by, when I noticed this really beautiful woman approach me, and we began talking. And she said, "By any chance, are you an actress?" And I thought, oh my goodness, good Lord, no. In fact, being in front of people and having to speak makes me want to vomit. But I didn't say that to her. I just laughed and said, "Oh no, no, I'm not." And from there, a friendship blossomed. What was made even cooler was realizing that she and I have the same birthday. And you know, I love me a good Pisces. So from then on, our friendship was off to the races. I've watched Janet's career and her life for several years now and was utterly thrilled when her book came out. It's titled Snow White Bites Hollywood, Then Hollywood Bit Back. I'll talk a little bit more about the book a little later on in the episode, but here's a little bit about Janet. She was a member of the Directors Guild of America, where she co-chaired the first DGA Women's Steering Committee. And in Hollywood, she worked on Remington Steele, Cagney and Lacey, Judging Amy, Caddyshack, Murder, She Wrote, and many, many more. She played a pivotal role in establishing the new film industry in New Mexico, and she also co-founded New Mexico Women in Film. But honestly, this woman is a trailblazer, and when you hear her story, you'll understand that she paved the way for women in Hollywood in so many different roles. She's really one of my favorite people, and so I'm so excited that this week you all get to meet her. So now, episode 158 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
There was a period in my life, and I think maybe I don't really have any relationship to why this was happening, but I seemed to really know ahead of time what was happening. One could call it psychic, one could call it just being in tune. But I would do things when I was at Remington again, because it was really at its peak then. There was a storm scheduled and we were going out to Malibu to shoot. And I went into the famous Abby Singer, and he called me in and he said, "I want you to change the schedule because you have us scheduled in 2 days to go to Malibu and this storm is going to hit." And I went back to my room and I sat and I just got really clear. And I went back to Abby and I said, "No, I can't change the schedule." And he said, "What? Why?" And I said, "Let's keep to the schedule. I just know it."
So I just absolutely adore you because you're so fierce and amazing and gorgeous. And the time I've spent with you has been really inspiring because you just were in Hollywood at a time that women were not really represented. And I'm excited for other people to get to know you. You're just so fearless. Would you describe yourself that way? Or how do you self-describe? If you had to introduce yourself to someone or to a group or maybe at a conference, how do you self-describe? Who are you?
That's an interesting question. And I think I wonder if any of us really know who we are inside and how we're perceived. And it has come to me from the book that I'm perceived as a very courageous person. I step back and go inside and go, "No, I'm shy and timid, and that's not true." And yet, if I examine that, I say, "Well, that's impossible. You couldn't have gotten where you were, which the book helped me realize, if I had been shy and timid. That's just not true. So I think in the heart, I might describe myself as a born and raised New Yorker. And people, I'm born and raised in New York City. And I think people who understand the kind of the bubble that that is go, oh, you must be pretty tough. And so I think that comes up a lot. I go, well, I'm born and raised in New York City. I didn't leave New York until I was about 27.
And is that where you kind of got introduced to, you know, acting and potentially the idea of being in films, or how did that happen?
I never wanted anything else but to be an actress. That's all I ever wanted. As a matter of fact, when it became obvious that that was not going to be my path, I went so low that suicide was definitely on the charts for me, because I never knew. It really starts, and I write about it in the book, because it really started, I think it even started before when I wrote about it in the book. I had a Scottish grandfather, my mother's father, and a bunch of cousins. I was an only child, but a bunch of cousins, and everybody would vie for his attention because he seemed quite stern, but sweet on the other end. And I would always get his attention because I would sing and dance. So I'm 3 years old dancing around the house in Brooklyn, and I got to sit on his lap. So then when I was in first grade, so I was about 5 years old, my teacher sent it, and I found this out after my mother passed away. My teacher sent a note home to my mother that I'd be left back. And because I was too unruly and too immature to go into the second grade. Now, I was the youngest one in the class, but still. So my mother created a puppet show. She built it and made little curtains, and I had puppets. And I took the puppet show to show and tell, and I did my little puppet show. And I created some sort of story. I have no idea. And there's another letter. There's a second letter that says, of course, Janet will be promoted to the second grade. I didn't realize she was one of those kids. One of those kids, meaning talented, and so therefore might be a little out of the box while she's uncontainable in the class. So I said, oh, great. All I need to do to succeed is to kind of perform. And that's how I wanted to be an actress.
Story. The other thing that I love is I have a lot of Scottish in my ancestry too. So you said,
I can see it on your face.
Yes, yes. It's unmistakable. Well, and I would love to talk about this book that you've just released, because it ties in to your experiences and the adventures and maybe misadventures that you had in your life, in your career, which is still ongoing. But what galvanized you to write a book?
People had always told me, tell us a story about that show. Tell us a story about, you know, Remington, Murder, She Wrote, whatever it was that I had worked on. And so when the pandemic hit, I said, well, I'm just going to write these stories down because they're beginning to fade from my memory. I had to write the book with my IMD page next to me because I'd go, when did I do that movie? And so that's how it started out, is just a bunch of stories. And then as I got through it, one neighbor in Santa Fe read it and she said, but I don't see you in it. And I said, oh, am I supposed to be in that book also? So then I had to re-look at it and put in some of my childhood, that story about performing and everything. And really examine. And as it went on, I realized the book was about power and control. And I thought it was only about power and control in Hollywood. But the reality is your power and control starts at the family level when you're very young. And if you don't, or if I didn't, I think everybody actually doesn't examine what's been fed to us or what we've begun to believe as truth about ourselves from our childhood, then that carries through and can show up at the most inappropriate times in our personal relationships and our careers. And when it showed up badly in my career, this lack of self-esteem that I had from childhood, it would threaten other people, because I believe it would. I really don't know what they believe. I can only know what results were. And so when it was all said and done, I really had to examine my family and then come to a full, then do research into my father, because he never opened his mouth about what had happened to him and who he was. And he dragged that with him into the family and never even told my mother. He wasn't, Davidson wasn't even his last name. So it was just this story that just got compounded. And once I hated the man, I really hated him. So once I really went beyond the, his being closed down and really said, what did I accept in from him that I didn't need to? Anyway, does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to tell you that, you know, when the pandemic hit, I went down memory lane. I just wanted things that were comforting and that I knew already. So I totally binged Magnum PI. I binge watched Remington Steele. I binge watched all these really fabulous, fascinating shows. And it was just comforting in a world that was obviously had turned upside down and everything had been changed. And so it was kind of nice to be able to go back and just revisit these moments that I'd watched when I was younger. And just, I don't know, the 80s were kind of zany and you never knew what was going to happen on these shows. So strange. And you know, I remember watching Remington Steele and seeing Pierce Brosnan for the first time and thinking, good God, is he gorgeous? Like, who is this person?
Standing next to him, you have the same thing. He still is, but he's quite stunning. And I think the first time I stood next to him at maybe the read through or a costume fitting or something to go, I just was like, oh my God, you're pretty, you know? But what makes him so pretty, he's really so nice. He's one of the good guys. He definitely is one of the good guys.
Thank you for that. And, you know, sometimes for shows these days, you get to see behind the scenes, you know, like what did it take to make the show? And, you know, they always talk to the directors and the director. Sometimes I look at what directors have to do and I think to myself, I would turn into a puddle and slink away. I could never direct anything. It looks so stressful, sometimes thankless, and just like the multitasking is insane. So how did you transition to that being possible for you?
Well, I was an assistant director for most of my career. And I will say, and I've been on record many times, the assistant director is by far the hardest job. Once I turned to directing, once you are in the directing world, it's politically difficult because you could easily offend an actor or you could easily offend a producer. And that's a political statement that's hard to deal with. But in the AD world, you actually are dealing with everything. And you are responsible for the safety of the set. Everything is in your hands. I rarely didn't know this. And I was doing a picture, my first picture. I don't want to say I was doing it with Sophia Loren. No, she was next to me once. I actually had a line. I would say, welcome to America was my line to her. I was a stewardess in this thing. And we were coming out of customs for the film, and we'd gotten so far, and the night was over, so they left us standing there, and the next morning there was a guy standing there who hadn't been there the night before, and I turned to him and I said, "You weren't there," because I knew that's where they were going to start the shot. I knew enough in my young age and my newness, I was about 21, to know that they were going to have to start that shot there because Sophia was in that group with us. And so he said, "Yes, I was." And I said, "No, you weren't." But I was so determined, I called the second AD over. And I said, "Then he wasn't there when we left last night." And the second AD, and he called the first AD over. And the first AD goes, "Well, this John," or whatever his name is, because they were all guys, says, "He was here, so he was here." And I'm going, "He wasn't there. He was." They were just not listening to me. And so I thought, God, these people didn't even take notes. You know it's going to start on this shot, and they didn't even take names and notes on who's going to be in that shot. I knew none of this. It was my first movie, but instinctually, it was like common sense. So we got ready to shoot, and Sophia comes out. By then, we were calling herself. And she comes out, and she goes, "Good morning, good morning, good morning. And you, sir, were not there." And he went scurrying out of there, back to where he was supposed to be. And I just thought to myself, oh, so that was important. I was right. I somehow knew that. And then through a series of things, I worked my way up to be producing. I left acting, worked my way up to be producing commercials. We always had to hire ADs for the commercials. And I had applied a couple of times to the DGA and was rejected. For various reasons. And so I called this, our regular AD wasn't available. I went down the DGA list. There was this person, Pat Curtis. And so I called, and this woman got on the phone. I said, "Hi, can I speak to Pat?" And so she said, "I'm Pat." And I said, "No, I mean Pat, the AD, Pat." And she said, "I'm Pat, the AD." And I said, I really literally gulped. And I said, "But..." She said, "Yeah, I know, I'm a woman." And I said, "Yeah." I had never seen a female AD. And all the people, all the things I'd done, I'd never seen anybody on the set practice. Hair, makeup, wardrobe was practically not female.
I'd love to ask them, what was your favorite show to work on, I guess?
Oh, any day now. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. The people were wonderful. The crew was wonderful. I got back to directing again because it had been a while since I had directed. And they were so wonderful about it. And the actors were, it was a wonderful experience. And the shows were relevant. And the one I got a NAACP, well, the show got an NAACP nomination. Image Award nomination was a show called Lighten Up, Renee, which dealt with discrimination within the Black community on the color of the skin, who was dark, who was light. And there was this group, and it was historically correct, that were the Daughters of the American Revolution, a Black group. But they were so light-skinned that they were turning away anybody who was, and that's what the show was centered on.
That's intense. My goodness. Yeah. Well, I'm so curious. Did you grow up in a religious household, or what did that look like for you guys?
I did-ish. my mother and my mother's family were Christian Scientists. My father's family was... They were all over the place. He was born Catholic, but scandals and all sorts of crazy things happened. And his mother converted to Christian Science also. But he had no religion. Really no religion. I don't know what he believed, because he never shared anything. But the form of Christian Science that I grew up in was stricter than what my cousins grew up in. And I'm not really sure where that came from. Something was going on with my mother. And so there was no help for me when my skin started breaking out. And that started around 9 when I first got my period for the first time. And I didn't even know what it was because there was no discussion about it. I remember my mother breaking down in tears and saying, oh, your life is over. There's so many things you can't do anymore. You can't swim, you can't dance, can't do anything. So it was a really skewed relationship. So there was no help for the skin. And that is ultimately why I left acting. Because if my skin was horribly pitted, and no matter how pretty or talented I was, every agent said, you got to do something about your skin.
I'm so sorry about that. You and I talked about, I remember we had a conversation about it once when we went out to lunch. And the one thing that I'm really appreciating about today and casting and, you know, the world that creates film and TV is finally, we're seeing diversity of actors. I mean, of every kind you could ever imagine. I mean, even with acne, it's just astonishing and it's so powerful. And I'm so grateful that we've moved into this. I'm sure 100% still a ton of people who are like, you have to be, you know, weigh 90 pounds and be 5'10 or something. I mean, that still exists and have plastic surgery and all that. But there are so many shows on where I just think, oh my gosh, there's a normal human being. There's someone who's like real. And I'm grateful for that because I think it helps viewers understand that you don't have to be quote unquote perfect or whatever people consider to be perfect to find success. So I'm sorry that happened to you.
Yeah. And on that vein, I tell you, I remember, and it was on Remington, which was my first show, that I was kind of in charge of the extras, as long as they didn't have lines. I mean, you're always in charge of the extras, but in hiring them too. And so it was written in the script that there was a mailman that came and delivered mail. So I went to the wardrobe department and I said, do you have anything that a woman could wear delivering mail? And they said, yeah, we can make something. They got excited about it, actually. Yeah, we can make something. So I mentioned to the producer, I said, well, you know, I'm going to change that. I was so bold. I'm going to change that. And it's, I've hired a woman, and a woman can be the male person. They went nuts. Not that I had overstepped any bounds. Well, maybe that too, but that I would conceive of this job as a female job. Look outside your window. Half of the male people who are delivering the mail are female. And why can't a woman... it was beyond me. I said, why can't a woman? Well, the packages are really heavy and the bag they carry is really heavy. And I'm going, huh? They ride around in little carts. You know? It's like, but that was how basic it went down, that basic. So when I got on Cagney and Lacey, and here were these two women, A, starring in a show, which didn't happen, and being head detectives, which didn't happen, it was really exciting. There was a period in my life, and I think maybe I don't really have any relationship to why this was happening, but I seemed to really know ahead of time what was happening. One could call it psychic, one could call it just being in tune. But I would do things when I was at Remington again, because it was really at its peak then. There was a storm scheduled and we were going out to Malibu to shoot. And I went into the famous Abby Singer, and he called me in and he said, I want you to change the schedule because you have a scheduled in 2 days to go to Malibu and this storm is going to hit. And I went back to my room and I sat and I just got really clear. And I went back to Abby and I said, no, I can't change the schedule. And he said, what? Why? And I said, let's keep to the schedule. I just know it. And for some reason, he went, okay, it's on you, though, when you have to figure out what we're going to do instead. I said, well, we'll stay and we'll do it. Well, we went out, we shot. It was absolutely fine. It started to rain as we were wrapping. It rained so hard that the set dressers couldn't get to Malibu for the next 4 days to be able. So if we had not shot that day, it would have been another 5 or 6 plus the cleanup. We probably wouldn't have even gotten out there. I can't explain, but from then on, Abby would call me in and say, okay, what do you think about this day? And I'd say, well, I think. So there were little things like that, where it just, and that's probably where the courage comes in, because what made me so determined that I was going to be right over the famous Abby Singer. Abby Singer is a legend. As a matter of fact, the last shot of the day is always called the martini. And that's how the crew knows to start getting ready to pack up and go home. But Abby, there was two rumors. One, that Abby never got it right. So, and the other one was that Abby wanted to fool the executives. So he would call the martini and the crew knew it was not correct because it was coming from him. So instead they started calling it the Abby Singer. So the second to last shot is the Abby Singer and the last shot is the martini. And that's throughout the world. And every film, there are people in foreign countries who are calling the second to last shot Abby Singer and they have no idea why. I was kind of oddly famous, not oddly famous, but the people knew me who would always kind of relied on it. Because when we were in trouble, I always had a back pocket, what I would say, oh, this is what we're going to do now, because now we can't do this. You know, if an actor was late or something like that, or blah, blah. And that leads me to a serendipitous story that I couldn't have, there's so much in my career that I could not have created, even having a career. I never could have sat down and knew that there's going to be a lawsuit with the DGA, and the DGA was going to have to look seriously at that lawsuit. And that's how I got in. And I wasn't part of the lawsuit for sure, but I became part of it and then worked for the first time from a lawsuit. But we had an actress who on Cagney and Lacey, and we were doing a story about Cagney and Lacey flying to California to extradite a criminal from California. So we were actually in California, even though we were always in California, but everybody thought we were in New York. And this actress didn't show up. And we figured out she was coming from Palm Springs. And when she left, we said, well, she's never going to be here. So the production manager turned to me and he said, you got a SAG card, don't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, why don't you do the shot? And I went, okay. And it was a shot in the hot tub. So I'm sitting in the hot tub with these two guys, and Tyne and Sharon come over, do the scene. And then they walk away and they call John Slusser, who is the production manager, over. And they hobnob, and John comes back to me and he said, "We got a problem." And I said, "Uh-oh, I'm that bad. It's been that long since I've been an actress. I'm just sitting there waiting." And he said, "Tyne and Sherritt said they won't do it unless you're naked." So they were just pulling my chain. And I could see them over in the corner giggling away, you know. And so I just put down my straps, put them underneath me, and said, "There, that's as far as we go." And so they laughed. But because of that, I heard Sharon talking. I turned to Tyne and say, "Well, she really is funny." And so suddenly, because when you're in production, producers kind of make a room for you, and that room says production only. When you're in writing and directing, even and acting, they have a room that says creative, and they keep those doors closed because they don't they didn't believe that they interchanged. And so at that point, I had been asking Barney to direct, and he'd been kind of putting it off, but the gals went into him and said, "Give her a shot." And it was based on me crossing the line to creative back in that hot tub, which is a stupid scene. I've looked at it now and I go, "Oh my God, am I bad?" But, but it's okay. So, and ultimately that Barney did give me a directing assignment.
So a series of kind of somewhat surprising and serendipitous events.
Nothing you could have ever, there's nothing you can plan. I couldn't plan any of that, you know, which when you read how it unfolded in the book, you just, even writing it now, I still say that's a journey that maybe happens once that some crazy thing happens, but then even getting back to directing on any day now, that only happened because my assistant wasn't available for the first episode that they were shooting. And she asked me if I would go back to ADing, and I really didn't want to AD a series again. I was really done with that. And I said, "Well, for you, I will, because it's your first shot really being a first AD." She had been my second for years. So I came in and I did one episode. And after one episode, they said, "What would it take to keep you here?" And I said, "Well, I really would like to get back to directing." Ultimately, I think I directed 12 of them.
You know, as you talk about these instances and these events that have happened, do you ever think back to yourself? I mean, honestly, like there were forces greater than you that kind of just gave you all these gifts or all these opportunities?
Yes. There was a time in my life when I was much more sure of what was happening in the universe, of a God and of a, part of that when I was really back in LA and quite low because for whatever happened. And a friend of mine said, why don't you go down to Agape, which was Reverend Beckwith's church. And the first time I walked in, I went, "Oh God, no, they're singing and crying. This is too much for me." So, but I found a week went by and I said, "Well, maybe I'll try that again." There was something. And then I was singing and crying. And that was a wonderful period of my life where I really studied and believed. I can't believe in a God that's a deity. I think it's impossible to believe that way. I can believe in an energy force that can be quite natural, that just goes around, that surrounds us individually and surrounds the planet. And I've always thought that when I'm out of step, I'm out of step with that energy force. And lately, I have found getting back to that area really, it's like the other day I sat and meditated that I was going to sell out all the books yesterday and everything was just going to be perfect, and started to pour as soon as 1 o'clock came, which was, it started to pour outside. So people are kind of dragging through Barnes and Noble. And I sold 8 books, you know, in 3 hours. That's not very good. And so I then go, well, I did all the right things. Am I in the wrong place? So now I question, I'm back to questioning and back to saying, and it's a good question you asked me, because it's like things did click. Even the negative things kind of were things that didn't hurt or scar that much until kind of the end. And then it really did hurt.
I think that just, I mean, I have this podcast, I have my books, I have my animated series, and it's, you know, I just think to myself, why am I doing all this? Because I'm not really, I mean, I have people who listen, I'm having some success, but it is exhausting. Like the hustle is exhausting. And I just have to keep reminding myself, just put yourself out there, just do it. Like, just get out there. So what? So what if your books don't become bestsellers? So what if the podcast isn't like one of the top podcasts in the world? Like, so what? Does it, is your heart captured? Is your heart happy? And I feel like with your book and your, that your heart is happy. Like Janet is in that book. And I mean, I am biased because I know you and I already think you're like the bee's knees. So, but I, all I think to myself is, oh my God, that was just like the first step on your journey of like getting out there, getting book signings and just putting yourself out there.
If somebody asks me a question and I get to pontificate, that's when I'm at my best. Yeah. You know, being in a bookstore and trying to trip people to come over and say hello to me, it's just not my thing. You know, how many times I smile and go, hi, hi, you know, and they go, hi, if anything. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I think is really interesting, and we'll close the interview out with this.
Well, I do want to say one thing back to
the other thing.
Because I think talking about this energy field, one of the things that has always tripped me up, always, is the feeling of doing so great that you're puffed up. And then the next moment, so low that it's suicide. There's nothing else. There's no in-between ground. And I think that's what trips up so many, because the highs are so, and that's my father, ultimately, I realized, was a manic depressive. So those highs, when he would win at the racetrack, were fabulous. When he lost at the racetrack, it was miserable for all of us. Totally miserable for all of us. And that remains my challenge. And I think it's a challenge because it's nice to enjoy that high, but it is not nice to enjoy that low. So how to get to the medium ground where the energy is pretty constant and doesn't have huge spikes like that is very important.
And it is so clear to me from the conversations that I have, everybody is beloved, but some people are more beloved than others. And listening to your stories about serendipity and these things coming together for you and just how astonishing it is, I just think to myself, oh, Janet's more than beloved. You've been kind of stewarded almost through your life so that you can have this success and have this recognition or meet friends or meet the right person or be seen. And I just think, I mean, I'm listening to you and I'm like, oh yeah. Janet's one of those.
Just like my first grade teacher. She's one of those. See, she saw it back in the first grade.
Love that image of Janet as a kid and being told, hey, you're not going to progress to the next grade. But then an adult in her midst seeing how talented and exceptional she was and saying, you're one of those kids. You are going to the next grade. In my heart of hearts, I so wish that each and every one of us as kids had that adult in our lives who told us how special we were, how exceptional we were. Not sure if that happened for you. I'm still trying to figure that out in my life, but that's what I wish for all of us. I'm so grateful to Janet for telling all of her stories because honestly, when I was growing up,
All of those shows were my favorites, and so it was very exciting for me to be able to interview her and hear her stories. I'm going to have a link to her book on the Treasures page of the website, but also in the episode show notes. If you get a chance, click on the link and check it out and buy the book. You'll be privy to all sorts of delicious stories and delightful anecdotes from Janet's days paving the way for other women in Hollywood. I'm also going to have a link to her website so you can check out a little bit more about this powerful woman. I also need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode, Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the episode's show notes. Thanks to all of you who listened to the podcast, and this week, instead of asking you to write a review or leave a rating, I would love to ask you to share the podcast with your friends. Share it with strangers. Share it on a bathroom stall. All the miracles and magic and the stories that I'm hearing, they need to be heard by more people, hopefully to help make their lives a little shinier, a little brighter, and remind them that in the end, this gorgeous universe which we inhabit really does have their backs and wants what's best for them. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Janet. Be a trailblazer. Where in your life is there a story that you can't do this, you can't do that, that the world isn't made for you? Where are you feeling boxed in? Be like Janet and refuse to accept those boxes, those lines, those rules that people want to put around us that say, you can do this, you can't do that. Be like Janet and be like, I give no F's, people. Get out of my way. I'm a trailblazer, and I'm going to change the world for me and for everyone who follows after. See you next week for episode 159 of the podcast. And until then, I hope your life is filled with beauty, with joy, and with conversations with strangers talking about this podcast. Thanks so very much, and see you so very soon.